This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. For more than a century, one company has controlled most of the world's uncut diamonds, the De Beers Corporation. De Beers was founded in South Africa by Cecil Rhodes in the late 1800s, a time when diamonds were becoming plentiful. But De Beers mined more than diamonds. The company mined the American psyche, creating one of the most enduring marketing campaigns in history. NPR's Jackie Lydon has part one of our series from American Radio Works on the international diamond trade, With This Ring.
Welcome to Breakfast at Tiffany's. On a recent morning at Tiffany's Premier Emporium on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, the new fall line of diamond jewelry was being introduced. Tuxedo-clad waiters bore champagne aloft. A jazz band made music, all of it a backdrop for stunning models who glittered with mesh filigrees of diamonds called lace.
Oh my God, I feel like a million bucks, you know, it's like a cliche saying, but I do. I mean, it's just, and it sits so perfectly, just divine.
Well, I think you might be close to half a million, huh?
Outrageously expensive diamonds like these are a Tiffany hallmark and a time-honored marketing ploy, but the story begins in the dirt. Tiffany's icon, a 128-carat canary yellow diamond called simply the Tiffany, was discovered in the 1870s at the Kimberley Mine in South Africa. It was the time of a feverish diamond rush as thousands of prospectors descended on the newly discovered mines. When their gems glutted the market, prices plunged from $500 a carat to 10 cents a carat. At that point, a young man named Cecil Rhodes saw that if miners put their shares together and formed one company, supply would tighten and prices stabilize. And so, in 1888, as it was becoming obvious that diamonds were anything but rare, Cecil Rhodes founded the De Beers Mining Company as a cartel of diamond producers.
This is all the De Beers operations, yeah.
No sign identifies the De Beers offices on Charterhouse Street in London. Secrecy is its hallmark. It's said that hidden among the bricks are cameras that cover every inch of space, powerful enough to capture the color of a person's eyes. And for good reason. Inside, the company's vaults have housed as much as $5 billion in diamonds in recent years.
Yes, safer than the Bank of England, we've always liked to pride ourselves on.
Andrew Lamont is the De Beers spokesman.
De Beers has operations in South Africa, Namibia, and Botswana. De Beers also has contracts with other major producers like Russia, the second largest producer in the world, and it has a contract to buy a portion of the Canadian production, and those diamonds come to London where they are put into one of 16,000 different categories.
By 1900, by knocking out competitors and buying up surplus, De Beers controlled an estimated 90% of the world's supply of uncut or rough diamonds. It was a fierce juggernaut. Matthew Hart is a Canadian mining expert and author of Diamond, A Journey to the Heart of an Obsession.
It was a ruthless, autocratic, dictatorial and you know, in every way kind of non-free trade kind of system. But the actual material, the sort of mystique and the gem, let's say, thrived under the De Beers system, did extremely well, held its value, and because De Beers controlled the supply, the illusion of the value of diamonds was sustained.
Hart says De Beers first courted colonial rulers and then their African successors. Gun-toting mercenaries defended its empire. But to truly exploit this empire, De Beers needed to stoke demand, especially in its biggest market, the United States. As America sank into the Depression of the 1930s, diamond prices and sales plummeted. De Beers' owners, the Oppenheimer family, responded by embracing the masters of myth. They hired the N.W. Ayer Advertising Agency to transform the public imagination about the diamond. For that, the company hired sociologists to burrow into American buying habits, and it hired the most visionary artists in the world to help.
I'm just going to read some of these other artists. You had Picasso.
All right, now we have a Picasso ad here.
Oh,
we
yeah.
have the one. I think it's the only ad he ever did.
For any ad agency.
That doesn't,
what the ads
really did was concentrate on a combination of emotion and status.
At the office of N.W. Ayer in New York City, company archivist Howard Davis gingerly fingers delicate original art produced by Picasso, Salvador Dali, and others for the De Beers account.
Early on, they told us that it would be a good idea to make a statement about what a young man should do for his fiancée in the way of a diamond ring. The idea that they were trying to get across was, if you love her enough, you're going to give her a month, you're going to spend a month's pay on it. Now, I don't know what happened now, because dealers nowadays say 2 months.
In 1947, a maiden lady copywriter at N.W. Ayer, Frances Garrity, created the most durable advertising slogan in history.
A diamond is forever.
Within 3 years, an estimated 80% of wedding engagements in America were consecrated with diamond rings, according to Matthew Hart.
The true genius of De Beers lies in having created a connection and sustaining in the popular imagination a connection between something that has no value at all. You can't eat it, you can't drive it home, you can't make clothes out of it, you can't build houses out of it. In creating a connection between that valueless item and something that is extremely valuable, which is human love. They created that connection, they made it up, and they've sustained it.
But advertising was only one tool.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Backed by De Beers, N.W. Ayer got Hollywood directors and screenwriters to insert into films scenes that captured the romance and adventure of diamonds. One N.W. Ayer memo from The Time reportedly stated, "We spread the word of diamonds worn by stars, women who can make the grocer's wife and the mechanic's wife say, 'I wish I had what she has.' Today we call that product placement."
Dorothy, didn't you notice? His pocket was bulging.
Yeah, that could be a bag of gumdrops.
No, it was a square bulge, like a box for a ring. I think he's got a present for me.
You know, I think you're the only girl in the world that can stand on a stage with a spotlight in her eye and still see a diamond inside a man's pocket.
Over the next 50 years, De Beers replicated this marketing success abroad in countries like Japan that had no diamond culture. But behind the scenes, De Beers was also solidifying its grip on the industry. Critics contend that the company is bare-knuckled, choking supplies and manipulating prices through the events it calls sites. Every 5 weeks, 125 manufacturers and dealers, handpicked by De Beers and called sight holders, flock like swallows to the company's London headquarters for these private sales.
What we call it is the buyer's waiting room.
De Beers' Andrew Lamont shows where the deals unfold at the company's London headquarters.
You can imagine this is like a sort of mini United Nations every 5 weeks. People from all over the world, these are the leading diamanteurs, being able to meet with each other, discuss trades, the market, the state of the market, and that's what makes it so absolutely unique and effective.
If this all sounds like a regular business deal, it's not. The men who come to these De Beers diamond sites are seeing those diamonds for the first time, even though they'll spend $500 million, the prices set in advance by De Beers. Author Matthew Hart.
Can you imagine a group of businessmen arriving anywhere else to buy $500 million worth of a product without knowing exactly what they were going to get for their money? It's completely insane.
Hart says that by compelling dealers to buy even those diamonds they don't want, De Beers deftly controls supplies and prices. That's one reason the site holder transactions have piqued the curiosity of the U.S. Justice Department. In 1994, the department charged De Beers in a price-fixing scheme. The company failed to turn up in court, and that's why De Beers executives don't dare visit their biggest market.
I'm certainly not senior enough to get arrested, but I do know that certainly none of us can go to America if it is to do with business.
For the record, Andrew Lamont rejects the price-fixing charges. He says De Beers controls its diamond supplies, much like IBM manages its computer inventories, putting them on the market as demand ebbs and flows. But the central question remains, are diamonds rare, or are their prices hideously inflated? De Beers officials are unresponsive. They will speak of how the company has democratized diamonds by offering them to millions of ordinary consumers, the grocers and mechanics' wives. But author Matthew Hart disagrees.
Today, diamonds plainly are not rare. There's a large supply of diamonds. In fact, there's more than 100 million carats a year of diamonds come out of the ground. That might be as many as 800 million separate stones.
Many of those diamonds are in places like Russia, Australia, and Canada, countries outside the grip of the cartel. These new competitors have forced De Beers to relinquish some of its market control. In addition, legal wrangles with the European Union and protests over diamonds from war zones in Africa, as well as plummeting demand for luxury goods, have rocked De Beers. It's therefore not surprising to hear talk of a post-cartel De Beers, says Martin Rappaport, the publisher of the Rappaport Monthly Diamond Report.
That De Beers, for the past 100 years, has been this we do what we want to do company, and if we violate antitrust laws, we don't care. Now, De Beers is becoming very repentant, very much wanting to be a member of the community. The company wants to be kosher.
But to be kosher, Rappaport says, De Beers needs to convince the U.S. government that the company is no longer behaving like a monopoly. De Beers officials say they're doing just that by selling off huge stockpiles of diamonds, loosening the rules of the diamond sites, and marketing an exclusive brand of diamonds. Writer Matthew Hart says this new De Beers is hardly the end of the cartel founded by Cecil Rhodes 2 centuries ago.
It is a smaller cartel than it used to be, where they controlled perhaps 80% of the world's supply of rough only maybe 6 years ago, 5 years ago. They now control anywhere from 60 to 65% of the world's rough, and that will probably go down to something like 50% in the next few years. But 50% of any commodity, I suggest, still makes a very, very powerful company, a very powerful marketer.
That's why everyone expects De Beers to be around and be a player for a long time to come. For NPR News and American Radio Works, I'm Jackie Leiden.